Okay, we're going to try to keep this as casual as possible. So welcome, everybody. My name is David McNichol, for those who don't know me. And Naima, are we all good with everybody online and recording and all those great things? Hello, everybody online. We're going to get going in just a few minutes. I'd like to make some remarks just about the business and some important thank yous. Then I'm going to ask Eric Compton to come up and join us, and we'll move the camera and we'll have a little, they call a fireside chat, something like that. But we'll pretend there's a fire there. But yeah, thank you very much, everybody. This is what our many people's first outing since COVID, and I really appreciate everybody taking the time to come out of their busy schedules. And unfortunately, Mother Nature didn't really help us today with people trying to get away, but we'll do our best. This is our 20th anniversary, and I can't believe 20 years has gone by, but I'm sure we all say that about various things in our lives, whether it's children, marriages, or what have you. But 20 years is a good long time doing something. And the main word I want to keep coming back to is teamwork. Without having a team and working well together, we wouldn't be here. And I started as a one-man show. Friday, September 17th was actually the real anniversary of the business. That's when we turned 20. And I'll never forget, it was on September 11th, 2001. We all know what happened that fateful day. And I was at my lawyer's office, Jim Craig, who's a lifelong friend and mentor. And, just really stressed out about life and wanting to move on from a previous partnership. And I was really anxious to get going. And I'm waiting in his reception. And I got to know his receptionist quite well over that time. And she tells me that there's a phone call for me. It's very weird. I pick it up as my father. I'm like, what? How did you track me down here? Like, what do you want? And he goes, well, Dave, I just want to let you know that a plane just flew into the World Trade Center. I go, Dad, why are you bothering me? It's just some Cessna probably. Like, don't bother me. Phone. Went in and had my business meetings with my lawyer. Then I jumped in the car and I drove from the Royal Bank Plaza to all the way up to Hanover, Ontario. And within a half hour, I realized what was going on. And I get verklempt right now, I must say, but I was very emotional. Mostly because I realized what was happening to these fortunate people. But I was really realizing that I'd made way too much about myself, and I turned it into sort of one person's problem, when now there was thousands of people who had some very, very dire problems. So that put everything in perspective. I obviously didn't want to say September 11th was the day that this business started, but it was a week after that, and I will never forget the starting point of this. So my number one theme out of this is believe in yourself. And this was all about just trying to get everything coordinated, especially just being a one-person show and having a number of very, very kind clients who followed me and had the faith from day one was so important. Here's a little quote. Of course, rely on Google, as we all do. And Google says that 51% of small businesses are 10 years old or less. 32% of small businesses are 5 years or less, and roughly a third of new businesses exit within their first 2 years, and half exit within their first 5 years. So I must say, getting through those milestones of 1 year, 2 year, 5 year, 10 year were very important to us, and getting to 20, once again, I just can't believe it. First of all, I'd like to thank our clients, and there's many of them here today. If it wasn't for you, we wouldn't have a business. So thank you very much from the bottom of our hearts. Thank you. We're constantly evolving and adjusting to future markets. And we've seen two major bear markets in the 20 years since we've been up and running. And we really live and breathe this 24/7. People know I play golf. I am thinking about it on the golf course too. I'd like to start with our important employees and really the lifeblood of the business. And Naima and Gal, if maybe you could just give a wave, Naima, so people know who you are. Nana's been with us for 15 years, and I think for the last 10, working remotely out of her home in Atlanta, where she moved to after she got married. And so she knows what working remotely is all about, and COVID really, we haven't skipped a beat. And I was a right-hand person. She's my confidant, and we would not be here today without her. Ross Healy. Ross, I know you're hoping to be here, but got waylaid. Ross and I have worked together for over 30 years. Ross is a very smart, dedicated friend and a mentor. Joe Poshdiniak. Joe, I'm sorry the timing. I think it's been almost 5 years.
Absolutely.
Yeah, coming up to 5 years. Joe's our portfolio manager in charge of our alternative asset program. Joe is a funny guy, smart guy, and very confident and supportive of the business. I really, really appreciate your involvement. Mark Dormer. Mark's our controller. And once again, I made up these years. I'm sorry I didn't go through employee files, but I believe it's been over 15 years. Yeah, and Mark helps in all aspects of the business. He's not just our controller. He keeps us on the straight and narrow, is what I wrote down here. And you really do. So Mark, thank you for everything you do. A newer recruit, Ed Bidding. There we are, Ed. Many years in the industry, and you're always willing to go the extra mile. And you're the hardest person, hardest working person I know. Literally, you got to go home sometimes. So anyways, appreciate all your hard work. Ken Reed, unfortunately, couldn't be here today. Ken's a research associate with us. And Ken, hello. And you're just wise beyond your years. Another gentleman that works with Ross, who was supposed to be here, but he had some challenges today, Gilbert. And Gilbert, I'm not even going to try to pronounce your last name because I will do a poor job of it, but you're a research associate with Ross, and you're a lawyer, so we always have someone to practice our lawyer jokes. And you do an excellent job with your fundamental and technical work. I'm getting there, people. Darren Ravi. Darren, there you are. Darren's our sales manager, and he teaches us all how to sell, but more importantly, to communicate with people in this very busy day and age. And I tell you, things have changed. Trying to communicate with people is constantly evolving. And so, Darren, thanks for everything you do for us. Lucas Bruno. There we are, Lucas. Lucas is a sales associate. Lucas actually came recommended by one of our advisor partners. Lucas has been on Dragon's Den. I'm sure he'll be happy to tell you about that after during the reception. And Lucas knows how to sell. Avery Wong. Avery's helping us here today as in charge of IT. Avery and Trevor Ho-Chan work together. And literally the most important part of the business. If we didn't have this technology working here today, of course, or every day in the office, and we wouldn't be able to function. So thank you for everything you do. One thing I did right from day one when I was a one-man show is set up an advisory board. I'm not allowed to call it a board anymore. The regulators don't like that word. So we have still an advisory council, an advisory group, and I'd like to thank John Francis. Saw you a moment ago. Hey, John, thank you very much for everything you've done. You've been a great supporter. And we're now sharing office space today, or now. We're the smartest guys in the room. We entered into a lease in February 2020, 5-year lease, and not knowing a month later, the whole world would shut down. But John, thanks for everything you do with us. Peter Buchanan, Ian Hall, and Bill Saunderson are also strong supporters and been there through thick and thin. We've really evolved the business over the years from working with one client at a time to getting advisors to help us. And we've developed a strong team of advisors. Many of them are here today, and I know many of them are online. And they've really helped us adapt the business and helped us grow. And it's really a way for us to not only help their clients, but to have someone who's on our side of the table and making sure that the clients are doing the right thing and staying for the long run. We also have an investment committee. We meet every Thursday morning. We rarely miss a week, and it's usually about 2 hours. And there's a number, I'm not going to mention the names today because a lot of them are sort of want to be anonymous when it comes to that group. But they're an excellent sounding board, and they've really helped us get to where we are. Joe, I meant to ask you before, our investment partners, I think, are in the 40 range now?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. So we've built up a very strong stable of investment partners for our alternative asset program, and I'd like to acknowledge every one of them. Thank you very much. You're really giving us all the direction and the growth that our clients need. And then our extended research team, we consider ourselves fairly adept at top-down investment analysis. And we've had groups like Woody Brock, Ross Healy again and his group, Dorsey Wright, Chris Dutton, just to name a few. Thank you very much for all of your support over the years. Our custodians, our brokers, they're a very important part of our business. And I'd just like to say just a huge thank you to everyone for supporting us all these years. Now, I hope we'll be around for another 20, but let's hope we get through the next quarter. So I think I'm going to try to segue out of that. And thank you for hearing us out for the important part of a celebration. But I'd like to introduce Eric Compton now. Eric, come on up, and we'll have a bit of a chat, and we'll try to keep things light as possible. And here, I'll just come over and join you.
All right.
Excited.
Gotta hold it right up to your mouth.
Okay. There's some more seats over here, folks.
Die, maybe they could wheel in some more.
Okay, beautiful.
Is this working?
Yeah.
Okay, so welcome, Eric, and hopefully we can lighten things up a bit, especially with people sitting down, and feel free to help yourself to a cocktail, too, if you like. I was fortunate enough to meet Eric a while back through another mutual friend named Michael O'Higgins. Mike's a mutual friend of both of ours. He's a golfer at a member at Indian Creek Golf and Country Club. And how I really met Eric was I was out with Mike. I was having a horrible round, and I was just keeping it to myself. And halfway through, in front of the whole group, Mike announced, "Dave, you know, I could get you a golf lesson." And that just made it worse. I held on even harder and bit my tongue more. And at the end of the round, I finally went up to him sheepishly and said, "Well, yeah, who do you have in mind?" He says, "Well, you ever heard of Eric Compton?" And I said, "Well, yeah." He goes, "Well, I'm friends with him. You can go have a lesson." So that's what I did 2 days later. And I met a fine gentleman and I believe a friend. And really appreciate Eric coming up here. And I'm going to sort of hand things over to you now. And let me just go through a bit, and hopefully you'll bear with my terrible reading here. But Eric was born in Miami, Florida, where he learned the game of golf at the age of 12. 6 years later, Eric was the number one junior golfer in the United States and the 1998 AGGA Rolex Junior Player of the Year. He accepted a scholarship to play at the University of Georgia, where he went on to become a two-time All-American, playing on the 2001 Palmer Cup and Walker Cup teams. We'll be asking about the Ryder Cup later. Eric is best known throughout the golf world for his two heart transplants. His first heart transplant came in 1992 at the age of 12, and his second in 2008 at age 29. Eric is the only professional athlete to compete with two heart transplants. For this, Eric was honored for the Ben Hogan Award in Augusta, Georgia during the 2009 Masters Tournament. In 2012, Eric received the Babe Didrikson Jaharias Courage Award from the U.S. Sports Academy. In 2013, Eric was among many distinguished recipients of the Donate Life Champion Award, an award given to role models in the sports community who have made a difference by inspiring others through their support for organ donation. Turning professional in 2001, good year, Eric played on the web.com and the Canadian tours of 2002, 2004, and 07. Winning twice in 04, earning Eric the Order of Merit title, and in 2005, continued his success by winning the Hassan Golf Trophy of Morocco. Actually, hopefully we'll hear about that. In 2010, after his second heart transplant, Aaron continued his pursuit of golf, making the cut in 5 of 7 PGA Tour events. In the 2011 web.com tour season, led Eric to earning his PGA Tour card for the first time. With 3 top 5 finishes, including a win in the Mexican Open, Eric has assured himself a spot on the PGA Tour for the 2012 season. Since joining the PGA Tour in 2012, Eric has played in 142 events, making 83 cuts, which include 5 top 25 finishes, 5 top 10s, highlighted by a runner-up finish in the 2014 US Open. Now, this is the part that's most important, I think. In 2014, he tied for 2nd in the US Open at Pinehurst. If any of you have ever played Pinehurst, it's a challenge at any level. And he tied with Ricky Fowler, sure many of you heard before, behind the winner, Martin Keimer. In 2013, Eric was honored with the PGA Tour Courage Award, which is given annually to a player who, through courage and perseverance, has overcome extraordinary adversity. That was a very long intro, and I'm sorry, but you've got a great website. I've sort of broken this up into 3 topics, and we're hoping people who are online can be writing in. Naima will be collating any questions. And if I don't cover things, maybe people in the group, in the audience here, can come up with some questions at the end. So why don't we start with family first, Eric? First of all, congratulations on getting married in March during COVID. And I had the honor of meeting your wife recently. And just moving on from family, immediate family, but to your extended family, your parents. Just tell us a bit about what sort of influence your parents had, obviously, as a child, but then how it related to your health and your health situation.
Well, first of all, congratulations to you. I mean, this is why I came up here to spend time with you, and you're a great man, and I've enjoyed the little time that we spent together. He's an excellent golfer, so spending time with him is nice to see another great player. He's not quite a pro, but he's... it's nice to be in Canada. I've been here quite a bunch in my life, and I'm actually 6 generations Canadian, so I told Dave that I might be more Canadian than he is. I was very, very fortunate to be raised in a really nice family. My mom is from Norway, and my dad is from Sacramento. And my dad was in the entertainment business. All of you guys are familiar with the cruise lines that go through the Port of Miami. And so my dad was a cruise director, and in his younger years, he was a singer and didn't quite make it to the big time, but he had a song that Merv Griffin actually bought for him, so he had royalties from that. And so he had a great eye for guys that were in the music industry and understanding how to build talent. And when I was a young kid, I was very ADHD. If you told me to do 3 things, I might get halfway through the first task. So my parents recognized my strengths and weaknesses, and I had a great father who put me in front of the right people and always built me up, made me feel like I was maybe better than I was. And I think that I got diagnosed with cardiomyopathy when I was 9 years old. So at 9, I was a pretty good athlete, and I lived to run around. And it was just, standing here today, it's hard for me to even put my mind around my whole story, because it's such a wild ride. But I definitely wouldn't be here alive today and had the success if it wasn't for the foundation of my parents. And that's pretty much what I've been advocating and trying to tell a lot of other transplant recipients when I travel through golf, how important it is to have a foundation. And I was just very, very blessed. I'm unlucky to get sick, but very, very blessed to have the family that I've had. And, so I owe a lot of my success to them.
Tell us about your daughter, Petra. She's 12 now, and she's taken up golf. Sounds like she's getting quite keen at it. And how is it seeing the sport through her eyes now? It's with everything you've been through with the game of golf.
Well, I was just thinking, I would love for you to read her the resume because the kids at the house think I'm a complete bum. But they're starting to get into the teenage years. I have a stepdaughter that's 17 and my daughter's approaching 13, but she's really enjoying the game of golf and in school, and they're both making great grades. And the last, through COVID, crazy times for my career and crazy times for everybody, but I've been able to be at home and be able to pick them up from school and spend a lot of time with them, take her to golf practice and teach her some of the things that I've learned. And I don't think I could ever compete with my parents how well they raised me, but I try to do my best. You know, I just want her to enjoy the game. I don't expect her to follow my footsteps. I think it's a lot of pressure for her to feel that. So we have a good time, we laugh, and as a professional athlete, seeing how other parents are raising their kids, I'm probably a lot more relaxed because I'm much more realistic of what the expectation of it, what the years come down the road. So I remember as a teenager, my dad always stressed detours, no detours, son, because it's easy when you get 15, 16 and get interested in girls and things traveling around. It's easy to get sidetracked. So, you know, my hope for her is that she can go and play college golf and enjoy the game. You know, even she has a game for life. So whether she goes into business later on, I think golf is just a great sport to teach our kids at a young age. And how did you get into golf? Well, my dad played in the Out Islands when he was working on the ships. And so he would play with his clients and his boss. And I was playing baseball, football, soccer growing up. And then I would tag along with him and play golf for fun. I never was really too interested in thinking I'd be a golf. I was always wanted to be a professional baseball player. And when I got diagnosed with cardiomyopathy, that sort of put a dent in those plans. And we had to relocate because their house was destroyed. And that was the same year that I had my transplant. And that was one hell of a year for us because I was 4 months after the transplant. But the transplant with the drugs in 1992 and the things that I had, I was a bit of a guinea pig at the time for the transplant community in South Florida. So I was almost being experimented on. I don't think they would ever give the medication that they gave me to kids now. So Hurricane Andrew hits. You know, my face was as big as this board here. I was beyond recognizable. And so I got into golf as a rehabilitation, and it gave me an access to compete. And I think that's pretty much as little that you know me is, and it keeps me continue going. I'm very competitive in whatever I do. And the kids were stronger than me, taller than me during those years. And so I was just competing against myself, competing against the course. And then all of a sudden, you know, within that year, I became the number one junior in the country. And there are strange moments in my career where I remember, and I was telling you, we were watching TV earlier about Trevor Immelman, who was the number one junior player in the country at the time. So Trevor Immelman was, the Tiger was a junior golf. And there's about 300 guys that showed up for this tournament. And I told my dad, you know, I don't really feel well. This was the beginning stage of the tournament, and I was having palpitations, and I was just thinking, you know, maybe I shouldn't play. And he said, well, you know, why don't you play one hole and see how you feel? I played the first hole, and I still was feeling the palpitations. And so he said, well, play another hole, see how you feel. That was kind of how my career has been. And, you know, 7 days later, I ended up winning the tournament, beating him head-to-head at the last. He kind of beat himself. I just hung in there. And that's pretty much how my career has been. I just I don't know if I'm necessarily the most talented guy or the most physically gifted guy, but I probably have the most heart out of all the guys. I don't quit. backing up to the U.S. Open, which is probably one of the biggest, U.S. Open is the biggest stage in professional golf, and my whole life I worked to get there. But I had to qualify, and I had to play 36 holes in the heat to get into the tournament, which was the week before. And I shot a 40 on the front nine and thought about walking off the golf course. And I said, you know, I'll stick it out. Let's play one more hole, and I birdied it. And then ended up getting in a playoff. And so it actually took me 40 holes to get into the U.S. Open. And so those of you who don't know golf terms, it was like a one in a million to get into the tournament. And I got into the tournament. They actually had parked the cars out and were playing with the lights on just to finish the round. And most people, 90% of the field, would have walked off the course after their opening 40. And so I tell a lot of junior players that you never know when things can turn around. Imagine if I didn't, if I had walked off the golf course, you know, I wouldn't have had finished that I had at the U.S. Open, which was just huge for me in my career. And, you know, millions of dollars later, I was able to, you know, buy a house and do things. And so as humans, we never know what our threshold of giving up is. And I just, like I said, I had my whole career is that when I had the heart attack and I had to go in for my second transplant, I called two people. I was engaged at the time. I called my fiance and I called my dad, and I got the first parking spot at the Jackson Memorial Hospital, and I was having a full-blown widowmaker heart attack. I was coughing up blood and I couldn't walk. So I grabbed somebody and they pulled me into the emergency room, and they if you saw me, I looked healthy. So they're like, what is this guy on drugs? What's going on? I said, something's seriously wrong. And so my dad met me there at the hospital, and they were already working. I mean, they had my shirt off. They had, you know, the whole nine yards, tubes everywhere working on me. And, you know, I was in the process of about to code out. And so I remember looking at him and my dad, he was, you know, as far as you are in front of me, thinking, well, this is going to be the last thing that he's going to remember. You know, this is the last time he's going to see me. And again, that wasn't the case. I ended up getting myself out of there. I was in the ICU for about 14 days. And then, you know, 6 months later, I ended up getting a second transplant, and my dad standing over my side and him saying, talking about golf, and thought he was crazy. I literally thought he was nuts. Like, why is he even thinking about it? Because I didn't believe that I could come back and have the career that I did after my second transplant. So when you were speaking earlier about a team and belief, I just had so many people around me that have pushed me and pushed me and pushed me. And, you know, I can't sit here and say I did this. You know, I had my family who's been a part of this. I was married before. Even my ex-wife was a part of this. My child has been a part of this. There's been so many people who have made it. And then let's not forget that there's two other families that lost their loved ones, and I'm living because they donated their life to me. So it's a lot. it's a lot to think about, and I think about it a lot, that when I put my head down at night, how lucky I am. Never ever dreamed I'd be live long enough to be 40 years old. And I still think and believe that I have more left in my career and great things to come. And we all should think that way. Everybody has to have a belief and think that the better days are in front of us.
Absolutely. You're inspirational. Just hit on a few things there that I'd like to go back to, one being your mother. And I know, I understand locating organs for transplant is near impossible. And what's involved to locate a heart for transplant, and how was she involved in that?
Well, ironically, our family was involved in transplant before I had my first transplant, because one of our best friends, our family's best friend, had a liver transplant in 1984. And she was one of the first in Pittsburgh, and her father was a ship captain. And so we would spend Christmases with them, and we saw what she went through, and she's still alive today and doing well. And so we were involved, and my mom was involved with the charity and the foundation raising money for transplants. And we had to raise money for a transplant house for patient services. So people, when they and families had a place to stay and pay their bills while they were going through a transplant. And then later, I took over the foundation, changed the mission statement a little bit, and tried to get more awareness through Donate Life, and also to help people in my situation to better the medications and maybe have a cure, so we don't have to have some of the worries that we have, because I still have to go in for checkups and do these kinds of things. The medications are a lot better, but there's not an exact science to it. It's like a formula for it, but it's so that's why I had to get retransplanted, because my first transplant I had a blockage in my heart. So, and my first transplant was 17 years, and now I'm 12 years. And so all heart transplant recipients have to go in to get checked up so that we don't run into these rejection issues or vasculopathy, which can basically shut down your heart. So that's what part of the research and the money that we raised for.
And just tell us a little bit more about the quantity of pills. Is it every day, or can you ever take time off? How does that affect your stomach?
I think I'm healthier than most 41-year-olds. I mean, besides the not playing the last 2 months in COVID and putting on, you know, maybe a little bit of pounds, I'm probably just because I'm enjoying life too much. But I feel good, and you know, I play tennis, and I'm very blessed. I'm lucky, I think, to be able to tolerate a lot of the medications and things that I've taken over the years. But you know, I take a little bit, handful in the morning, a handful at night, and I'm just used to it by now. I mean, I've lived most of my life with somebody else's heart, so I don't really know what it is to be normal. I mean, I've touched on it before, like, you know, when I think the reason I played well in major championships or in bigger events, harder courses, is because I think the field is probably feeling what I feel all the time. So it levels out the playing field. You know, my heart is higher, and I don't have vagal nerve, so my heart's is at 130 by the time I tee off, and by the time I'm finished, it's the same. So it's like running a marathon the whole day. So, you know, most everybody to an extent chokes under pressure. It's just how much. And so that's what I get a thrill for. When I play normal golf, my heart rate's 90, and I don't really feel, but I'm an adrenaline junkie. So I guess I embrace the uncomfortable feeling of it.
This is a question that came from one of our staff. What do you do to stay focused in the long term when the short term is uncertain?
Well, the short term has been uncertain since I was 9 years old. So again, I don't really know the difference, other than that you get to a point where I remember the doctors telling me, one of my doctors, I was explaining to him my fear. He said, "What are you worried about? I mean, so if you die, you die." And what? It's something to say to somebody who's in their early 20s, right? Like, I got a lot of life to live. So I've taken a lot of chances in my life. I don't say no too much. And when there's opportunities to do fun things, I do it. Nobody knows the future. Somebody can walk out of here and get hit by a car. Somebody can live a perfect life, be in perfect shape, never have done anything, walk a perfect life and have a short life, right? So like I said before, I've exceeded my expectations. I never thought I'd live this long. So if something were to happen to me today or tomorrow, I mean, I kind of feel like I've had that adrenaline and that. And so I tell people, if you really are really worried about it, you probably haven't lived your full life or taken any chances. I've taken the windy road. I haven't taken a straight line. And I don't think life would be fun if it was easy. I mean, you went to the game the other night. You saw the Bills beat up on the Dolphins. That wasn't fun, was it?
That's not fun.
It was boring. It was too easy for you guys.
Yeah, but I did see your competitive nature come through with your Dolphins struggling. Let's go back to golf and your early days. And I had the pleasure of meeting a longtime friend of yours, Josh Banks, earlier today. He talked about, you know, what a phenom you were at in your junior days. And so this, you're still recovering from this. And at age 18, maybe just take us back to what it was like and how you're meeting these stars, like even Bubba Watson, I mean, is behind you on your team. So tell us a little about Georgia Tech. And
well, that's University of Georgia. We translate.
University of Georgia, excuse me. Yeah, sorry about that. Edit that. But no, just go back to sort of age 18 and then going into college.
Yeah, that was an exciting time in my life. It was exciting for my parents and, you know, to come out as the number one recruit in the country and then be a transplant recipient. I think it was confusing for a lot of college coaches because, you know, they're like professional scouts themselves. They're like, well, you know, what is he going to bring? He's 130 pounds and he's a transplant recipient. Is he going to be able to play at the college level? And so there were some that took risks on me and some that didn't. I ended up getting a full scholarship to the University of Georgia and actually was redshirted my freshman year. They won the national championship. And I was in Ireland playing in the British amateur. And there was a lot of college coaches that were disappointed because I could have started for some other teams, but our team was really, really deep. And heck, they won the national championship and I didn't even play. So my first tournament was my sophomore year education-wise. And I was paired with Adam Scott and Charles Howell in the final round in Sea Island. And I won the tournament, my first college event against those guys. And I remember getting this to ride back in the front seat with the coach. And so, you know, the funny thing of, you know, Bubba Watson was on the team and we had Ruggie Amato. We had a lot of great players who went on to play on the tour. We had five guys in the top 15 in the country, which I don't think that's ever happened even to this day. So we won just about everything. But what made us so good is that we had a love-hate relationship for all the guys on the team. Each one of us wanted to be the star on the team. And so it drove all of us crazy because we wanted to be the best. It was just, you know, there's an old saying like, you know, show me who your friends are and I'll show you who you are. And there is a little truth to that, or a lot of truth. We were all pushing each other to become the best. And, you know, Bubba Watson has gone on to probably make $50 million in his career and won two, and he wasn't even on top five on the team. So, figure.
Well, that's a good segue to the Ryder Cup and talking about players not necessarily getting along, and then other teams where it looks like everybody gets along marvelously. What do you think is going to happen with the Americans against the Europeans? And maybe talk a little bit about some of the American players you know.
Am I being recorded here?
No, ignore those lights.
Well, the Ryder Cup is it. I mean, you got to be crazy not to be excited as a PGA player. To get on the Ryder Cup team is so difficult. And I came very close to making the Ryder Cup team in 2014-15. And I actually forfeited my eligibility to play in the Olympics because I was going to play for Norway in the Olympics. because I was so close to making the team. I think I was 17th on the Ryder Cup standing points. Tom Watson was hitting balls next to me at the PGA and asking how my game was. And I was hoping maybe he would pick me as a Ryder Cup pick. But I didn't deserve to make the team because I ended up not playing well at the end of the season. So it's a little disheartening sometimes when I see the media and see some of these guys think that they don't really care about the Ryder Cup. Maybe they're just too good for it. But I think all of them are extremely excited to be a part of it. I think the Europeans are probably a little bit closer in camaraderie and what it means for them to take on the United States. But the United States, I think, on paper has a better team. But that, again, that doesn't necessarily mean that they could walk all over us. But I do think the golf course is more set up for the Americans. And it should be an interesting match. Hopefully we can hold together. We'll see. Your guess is as good as mine.
I know, actually, on our invitation, probably many people noticed a quote from Tiger Woods. I meant to have it in my notes, but I don't. But it was a very favorable quotation about yourself. And I know he used to be on speed dial with you and through his challenges and that. But maybe just talk a little bit about what Tiger has done for you and what you might have done for him.
Tiger has captured all of us as in the golfing world that are younger than him. I mean, we look up to him, and he's arguably the best player ever to play the game. I remember being at the Transplant Olympics in 1992 and watching on a little screen him win the U.S. Amateur. And then he came down and played in Miami and did a clinic. And I was there, and his dad was there, and they looked at my grip. And it was a big deal for him to be hitting balls doing a junior clinic at our place. And then to be able to play in the same tournament as him, I was 18 years old at Doral. It was my first tournament. I played as an amateur, but it was a pro event. I played with Gary Nicklaus. So Jack Nicklaus walked the whole 36 holes with us. And I saw Tiger. And at the time, I was probably a little bit too young to understand what Jack Nicklaus was all about. Later on in life, I spent time with him and still think his record will hold. But I was starstruck to meet Tiger for the first time. I was almost nervous to meet him. And then later on in my career, played practice rounds with him, and I had a couple shots with him at Torrey Pines coming down the stretch. And I remember I was tied for the lead with him going to the third round, but they didn't repair us because the weather was bad. We walked, everybody was already out on the course. We walked into the clubhouse. I walked in to get my shoes cleaned. And I didn't know he was behind me. He was probably 30 feet behind me. And the guy cleaning our shoes turned to him and said, "Congratulations." And I said, "Give my shoes back," because the tournament wasn't over yet. So he was already congratulating for the win. Tiger had a smirk on his face, but he's always been very, very kind with me. And obviously the last few years, I think he's had a lot of things going on, and we spoke a little bit, but I'm not great friends with him, but I think he's always had a respect for my story and the things that I've gone through, and I've always had a respect for his game. And I think the guy is an amazing athlete, amazing golfer, and he has his own crazy story. So hopefully we'll see him again, and he can play and do exhibitions, or who knows? Can't rule the guy out, but I'd like to just see him happy.
So going back to 2014 and tied for second in the U.S. Open, you talked about that already, but that actually got you exemptions into other majors. Maybe talk about playing in Augusta and making it to other majors.
Yeah, the a huge rush to be able to play in the Masters. Unfortunately, after the U.S. Open, which a lot of people don't know, I went in for some some checkups and they thought that I had some stuff going on. So going into the Masters, I had a lot of things on my mind. I still made the cut, but I didn't know where my career was going. So thankfully with some medication, they were able to turn some stuff around. And it was a great moment. But I do remember walking up on 18 thinking how cool this is to be a part of this. But I didn't know where my career was going after that. So going into the tournament, I don't think I was as prepared for the Masters as I was the U.S. Open. And I think the competitor in me was a little bit upset that I didn't play better. That's just the way I've always been. So when we talk about majors, for me, I feel like the tournaments that I play well in, and the ones that I struggle, I just try to not look back on them. But I will say that Petra, I have a picture on my phone of my daughter Petra with a white suit on, and she was 6 or 7 years old, and she caddied for me in the par three and hit some putts in. And it's a great moment. I mean, not many people can say they competed in the Masters, or let alone even say they played the golf course. So it's pretty neat and very lucky.
That's fantastic. So before we open it up to the questions from the room and maybe online, Nyla, if there's any standard questions there, just want to come back to a final comment about teamwork. And we talked a little bit about our team and our business. Just talk about the team that's been supporting you over the years, and now what does the team look like now going forward?
Well, I've been very blessed to have a lot of people who have believed in me, with sponsors as well. I could go on and on with a list of names of people who've supported me, and it's been a new chapter. It's kind of neat this last year. I signed up with Encore, obviously. You play, and Encore is a golf ball that it's been exciting to be a part of their team. As getting into my veteran years, to have some input on a great product, that's exciting. And I look forward to that chapter and the next chapter of moving forward as a player. And Kane Anderson Real Estate has been a big part of my career and getting me into tournaments, and this year being able to play in Colonial. Charles Schwab giving me an invitation to play there, and then to back it up with great play. It's one thing to get a start at a tournament and then not perform, but I think I was in 6th or 7th going into Sunday, which is a little less than a year ago. And during crazy times, traveling with a mask and all this kind of stuff as a transplant recipient is pretty scary. So I kind of forfeited the end of the season because of the Delta variant, and I just felt, you know what? Why do I need to push myself? I've had a great career and I still have time coming forward. So my team and the people who were involved with me just said, chill out. And I think you got to listen to yourself and listen to the people who are around you and love you. And so that's just been a great confidence, because it wasn't a decision that I made on my own. It was a lot of people around me, the doctors and stuff. So it's exciting times, and I look forward to having a lot more great events coming up in the future.
Thanks. Nyla, do you want to maybe start us off with a question, and then we'll go to the audience?
I'll open it up now, but there isn't any right now.
Okay. Ron.
In the room.
Your story is an inspiration to all of us. Amazing. I had the pleasure last year to sit down with Casey Martin, another pro professional golfer who had a series of a medical conditions. And he was sitting down on the drinks, and told me he was just appalled. He asked for the special treatment to use it all. At some of the comments that came forward from some of the leading things, including the friend Mr. Nicholas, that he shouldn't be allowed to use the card on the model course. So, did you ever ask for any special compensation with using the card? Were there any negative feedback from some of the bigger names that you had something awarded to you special because of your medical condition?
Great question. I know Casey very well, and I think he's a great guy. What he went through and went and stood up against the PGA to get a card, I don't see the reason why that was ever an issue. He should have been awarded a card. He has a disability. So he kind of created the pathway for people with disabilities. And when I did have my second transplant, I was awarded to be able to use a cart. And I would tell you, I submitted papers from here to the ground of my medical stuff, and they still ask for it, which is pretty wild. So they're not, they take it very serious so that people don't take advantage of the system. And I got a little kickback when I used the cart, because I went through Q school and played in the PGA event, made the cut, and you know, guys that, I mean, and I see it from their perspective too. Like, they've never been through anything in their life. They're healthy, and then all of a sudden, somebody's coming around parking a cart right next to the green and kicking their ass, right? So they don't like that. Excuse my French, but guys don't want to get beat by somebody who's handicapped. And I know both sides. I'm healthy now, but I do have a little bit of a disadvantage with my situation. But there might be a day where I have to apply for a cart, or use a cart. And there's probably PGA events that I could have won in my career had I used a golf cart. But I don't, for me, the challenge is, again, it's the fight and the goal to win against myself and win against the course. So it's a dream of mine to win walking and playing. But if I couldn't, and I physically couldn't do it, I would use a cart. As for Jack Nicklaus, he never said anything to me personally. And some of the top players have never said anything to me. They've been nothing but supportive. So sometimes people say things that maybe, you know, in the context that are maybe misunderstood. With that situation, I remember Jack saying something about it, but I think they were all fully supportive of me on the tour. It was really the guys that didn't have tour cards, you know. Sometimes you get more grief from players that have no career, and that's just the way it's like that in anything in life, right? Like, the people who have made it and done it, they know what it takes. It's the guys that haven't made it and done it are the ones that are jealous.
Okay, other questions? Okay, well, I think you've answered them all.
There's got to be one question out there.
Andy?
What do you think about the inner dynamic of the Ryder Cup with Kepka and DeChambeau? That'll overshadow anything? Do you know those guys?
I do know them, but again, I think it's just media hype, right? Without Tiger, what? It's really hard to carry the torch on the tour without Tiger, right? I think Fowler had a lot of pressure with him. He was a big star. You know, DeChambeau is an interesting guy and says a lot of interesting things, but it's difficult when you don't have Tiger's most recognizable athlete in the world, who we were lucky to have him in golf, right? So that there's a lot of stuff that's going on with media that I don't understand. I mean, we're celebrating guys that lose, and they're bigger than the guys that actually win. So it's a very strange time.
Which is my question, because it seems like it's media driven, but I don't know the personalities. You would. So.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's hard to tell. I think that there might be a little bit of a feud, then the media picks it up, and then they make something, and then, you know, they love it. It is bizarre to me, but there's money for these guys to be made because of the arguments and the whole shenanigans.
Yeah.
It's all about money behind that. Everyone loves a drama, right?
Absolutely.
Sir, Eric, how are your children, how have they accepted or know about the transgender members?
What was your first name again?
Eddie.
So Eddie and I spoke earlier, and he's also a heart transplant recipient. So I think, you know, I get recognized because I'm a golfer in my story, but you should be recognized too, because I'm sure whatever you've done in your career, in your life, is just as important. So congratulations to you with your success as a transplant recipient. And you have kids too, so you know it. My daughter has seen and read a lot of stories about me and questions that people ask, you know, how long I'm going to live or what the medications do. So I'm so proud of her because she's her own character and her own person and deals with it in her own way, right? So not only am I affected, I've affected a lot of loved ones around me. And the older I get, the more I really appreciate and understand as a professional what I have done to everybody around me that is close. So hopefully I make her proud and I don't, because it's stress for her, sure. So she deals with it in her own way. And you know, I know when I went through my transplant, it was very hard on my brother because he had to take a back seat, right, to everything that I went through. And if he had a cold, he was basically shipped off to Norway to live with my aunt and uncle when he was in his teen years. So you know, he still gives me grief for that. But in many ways, we were a great family, and he's way more successful than I am in his career. It's taken him time to do it, but my parents did a good job of keeping all of us together and dealing with my transplant. And for them to even be together as like mom and dad, to be together and stick it through all these years together, where some nights my dad was in the hospital with me for, you know, 30 days. And I can't imagine what it would be like, because my kids are healthy, as a parent, to go through what my parents went through. So it's pretty amazing.
Ross.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff in like about front testing. So what happens to you when you get into a tournament and they say, well, okay, let's go.
Right. We'll see what's going on. It's a great question. It depends on which tournament. I'll tell you a funny story, and I know that other transplant recipients that might be in the room besides yourself, with all the medication that I've taken, my kidneys are not as strong as a normal person, right? And so when I got drug tested, I would get drug tested sometimes off at 6 o'clock in the evening. I'd come in and do random drug tests. And my kidneys are not going to work until about 12 o'clock at night, until I lay down and get flat. So I remember playing a tournament. I shot 62 at Sedgefield. I was winning the tournament, and I could not pee in the cup after the round. And I had to do the drug test before 12 o'clock or I was going to be disqualified. Well, it turns out I ended up having to withdraw from the tournament after leaving the tournament for the first day, because the only way I could get myself, my kidneys going, is I started having a couple cocktails. And if I had a beer or a vodka, it would get my kidneys going, right? It was like a diuretic. But I ended up withdrawing with gout the next morning because I had a huge gout flare up, probably from being dehydrated and having the vodka and then getting drug tested. So I think it's kind of a funny story. I mean, yeah, it's not great that you're winning a tournament and have it, you wake up the next morning, you can't even walk. But I did all the drug tests. I mean, I probably could have fought it, but I would have rather them actually stick a needle in my arm than do the pee test. But I only took one drug that was illegal based on the tour. That was a beta blocker, and that was only to try to keep my heart rate from already being elevated. And half the tour probably takes it anyways. So, and they have a note from their doctor or whatnot. But the other, as far as like steroids and things like that, there have been a few players that have been caught with that. But you know, I wouldn't mess around with any of that kind of stuff.
Bill, how difficult is it?
It's extremely difficult because you have to as a rookie, when you come out, you get bad tee times and you don't get into all the tournaments, and the better players already have a head start because they're playing in the World Golf Championship events and guaranteed money and no, there's no cut. So I had to go back to Q school one time after, I think, my rookie year, ended up finishing fourth in qualifying, and then started having my great year. So it's extremely difficult. And people who can keep their PGA Tour card for 15, 16 years is super impressive. Like a friend of mine, Pat Perez, for him to be able to do that without winning, he's won, I think, a few times, is extremely, because, you know, if you have a bad year or have something happen with a family or whatnot, it's difficult to every year you have to make $1 million to keep your card. That's not easy.
Yes, sir.
What do you think about the rules or new rules for the gallery taunting, harassing players? Is that a solution in search of a problem, or is that a problem that can be addressed?
I haven't really given it much thought. I think it's sort of crazy that we have to think about that, because we didn't have fans 18 months ago, and now the fans are out there. Now we have to like regulate what people are, because they're getting taunted at. Yeah, it's a bit bizarre. I don't know. I mean, if you have somebody out there completely heckling you, which I've had happen, if you're playing at the stadium course in Arizona, and you just can't believe the things that are going on inside the ropes. And then, you know, that can be distracting. So as a player, if you're a top player in the world, but Tiger never dealt with that. And if anything, he dealt with it more than anybody, even more than what's going on now. So I don't know. I don't know how I feel about it.
I was just wondering, you were saying before how you may not have been the strongest, but you held in. How do you get yourself in the mind frame? Golf is very mentally challenging. So not being the strongest, having a heart transplant, how did you do it? How did you get in the zone when it really mattered?
I did some training in the off season, and I pushed myself. Believe it or not, like, I'm not in the best shape right now, but in my early 30s, even after the transplant, I would go out and run 8 to 10 miles 3 times a week, and I would push myself to almost, I passed out. Now, I'm not saying that's the great thing to do, but again, I got a huge confidence out of how much I could push the heart that I had. Maybe not necessarily the greatest thing, though. So when I got into tournaments, there's a lot of tournaments where I didn't feel well. And you learn how to embrace it and deal with it. And then get to a position where you can get back to the hotel and rest, and get away from people, and then recover. Because all golf is, or any professional sport, is about how you recover. And it's very difficult to recover normally, but as a transplant recipient, when you're in that situation, and there's not a lot of people that I could talk to that have had transplants. So I'm trying to learn it and tell doctors what I'm feeling. And they're like, yeah, you shouldn't be feeling that. Well, I said, well, you know, they tell me why, you know, I just argue with them, but, I did everything I could to try to get my heart rate down once I was done with the tournament, watch movies and do everything I could, because you can't, your mind is just keeps going. And as you know, in business, or you have something on your mind and you go to sleep at 9 and you know you have to do it first thing in the morning, and your brain, you're sleeping, but you're thinking about it. And I often thought, if I wasn't in that situation, then I really wasn't in the tournament. So if I put everything I had into a tournament, the next week I was wiped out. So I knew that I put everything into it.
Let's just wrap up here, and then we can have a nice reception and cocktails, so forth. But here's a couple of final things I'd like you to go over. What would you say to people about signing their donor cards?
Well, I I was the national spokesperson for Donate Life, so I went around and visited a lot of hospitals and a lot of patients, and there was even New York tried to do presumed consent where it would be automatically assumed that you'd be an organ donor. And I don't want anybody to make a decision that they don't want to do. I just present them the facts, present them my story, and maybe they would think about it and tell their parents or loved ones that this is what they their choice to do. I don't ever want to force somebody to do something they don't want to do, but I just share my story. But I do think it's important. I mean, it's an important decision to make with your family.
And just let's conclude with a few little bit of insight into the foundation that you operate. And I know it's for Americans, but is there a way for Canadians to get involved?
Yeah, well, I mean, we should run a tournament together. We should do one up here. It's been tough the last 2 years because of the COVID, so we haven't had a chance to raise awareness and do a tournament. And then also when the tournament was lost at Doral, I lost the access to a lot of professional players. So I was about to partner up with another foundation, and we had run some tournaments around the country, but anybody could be involved. Anybody who has ideas to help organ donor awareness and to run events. But I'm gonna get back to running a golf tournament back in Miami. And that, you know, that those are the things that I look forward to in the future. And I think Encore has a great platform for me to be able to do a lot of things. Look, you and I met, you met Encore, and I have great sponsors that want to be a part and support what I'm doing. And I think the people that believe in me, they're not just believing me because I can hit a golf ball, but they're believing me about this stuff. Because more importantly, the foundation and the stuff that I can do and meet people is more important than the golf. And I will leave on one story. I spoke to a young man yesterday who's a good friend of mine, Kevin Garcia. And through the foundation, he contacted me 12 years ago, his family, and the doctors as well had contacted me. He had a transplant at Jackson Memorial Hospital, and he wouldn't speak to anybody. He went mute, completely mute. He was so traumatized with what he was about to go through, he wouldn't speak to anybody. So I went into the hospital, and I tried to get him to share my story and to get him to talk. And so I put a golf bag with a few clubs in a real staff bag. I put it in the corner of his room. And he and I today are great friends. And he's a full-blown adult with a beard, but he was 12 o'clock. He was 12 years old. He's 24 now. And he shared what an important moment that was in his life. So the things that you can do with your contacts and who you are as an individual, you can never lose sight of the differences that we can make in people's lives just to start something. And so that was a huge part for him to be able to see that bag and realize, hey, I did it, he can do it. And he's gone on to do great things. So that's what the foundation's about.
Well, that's great. I really appreciate your time and just your message. And you totally started something here today, and it's got my brain ticking. It's like starting a business 20 years ago. You just don't know what's around the next corner. And, so I really appreciate your insight, and we're going to make sure that the foundation is properly recognized on this this audio. And this. And by the way, everybody will be able to tune in, so you get a link to this. And if you want to share it with any friends or family that weren't able to make it, that would be wonderful. And anything that comes back to Eric, I think will go around to all of us. So thank you very much for everything.
Okay, well, let's have a drink.